This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/beherenow.
You know, when we were talking about going to that monastery, it's like, to me, the idea of a three-year practice, it's the depth of it, right? Like, it's that you get to go quite far into it. And so far, the place in my life where I've had the great gift and opportunity to go far and go deep is in an entrepreneurial stuff, so that, you know, once you're in a certain track with that, it keeps cooking its head up. There's more to be deep here, and I would be such a novice in the other practice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that thing, is where am I going to reach the greater depth and the greater challenge?
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nickturn on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist. On behalf of all of us here at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon, we sincerely hope this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are grateful that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guide, David Nickturn, discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And boy, we've got a juicy episode lined up for y'all today. We have Justin Evans with us, who is currently the COO of PlayFit, an AI-based fitness app that gamifies health and exercise. Justin is also a Buddhist practitioner. He studied with David and been a member of our Dharma Moon Sangha. So in this episode, we really hear the two of them diving into the complexities of being a business person and entrepreneur, endeavoring to have one's activities in that arena align with spiritual practice. Interestingly, this discussion was recorded in October of 2022, before we had a short break at the podcast. And since this discussion, ChatGPT has been launched publicly and profoundly shifted our relationship with technology and AI. So it seems that this pod being released at this time is very synchronous with our current conditions. Themes discussed in this episode include ethics, karma, and interdependence, and how they relate to what Justin refers to as the Promethean bargain of tech entrepreneurship, the complexity of bringing heart into business, Tantra and its relationship to creativity, and also building microtonal musical instruments. Since Justin has worked with David one-to-one, there are also some great questions from Justin in relationship to all this, leading to some really warm dialogue back and forth between host and guest. Speaking of working with David, have you considered taking our Dharma Moon 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training? Would you like to deepen your own practice while cultivating the ability to lead others into an informed and effective mindfulness meditation practice? Well, we have our next round of teacher training coming up, and if you would like to learn more, you are invited to a free online info session on February 14th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time with the esteemed and erudite Professor Robert Thurman as our special guest. Head over to dharmamoon.com to sign up for the info session. And if you can't make it on February 14th because you have some kind of romantic previous engagement for some reason, it's all good. Sign up anyway, and you will receive a video of the info session via email. And I get it. As a professional musician years ago, I had a recording session on Valentine's Day, and I'm pretty sure the relationship I was in never recovered. So perhaps we can all learn from the follies of my youth. And speaking of love, if you're into loving awareness, you should check out all of the podcasts on the Be Here Now Network. While romantic love, or eros, as the Greeks called it, is only one star in the constellation of love, we can learn from the vast store of wisdom of our ancestors and lineages and tap into that timeless, primordial nature of unconditional loving awareness that is our true nature. And a great way to do that is to head over to www.BeHereNowNetwork.com, where you can hear Ram Dass's legacy of loving awareness continuing in our Mahapad Sangha. So please check it out. Okay, so here's some quick biographical info on Justin, and then we'll get to it. Justin Evans is co-founder of Lander.com, a company that used machine learning to unlock great sound for all music creators, which gained over 1 million users in 3 years of being live. He's been interviewed in major media, including the New York Times, Boston Herald, Vice, TechCrunch, Billboard, and Music Radar. He has guest lectured at Stanford University, Carnegie Mellon University, and more. He's been featured as a panelist at South by Southwest, A3E, San Francisco Music Tech, and more. And currently, he is the head of product and COO of PlayFit, a startup that is dedicated to gamifying motivation to help people lead healthier lives. All right, there you have it, friends. The table has been set. It is our pleasure to share with you episode 40 of the CSM podcast, Entrepreneurship, Technology, and Spiritual Practice with Justin Evans.
Okay. Welcome everybody back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. Today's guest is Justin Evans, who's actually probably one of the most qualified people I know to address all three dimensions of our weave that we've been trying to thread together. So I met Justin before I met him, actually, through software that he had developed. I'll talk more about that. But and then he is a dedicated Buddhist practitioner as well, and an entrepreneur, and a very creative person. So, Justin, welcome to the podcast. It's so great to see you again and to have you for an hour.
It's great to see you again, too, David. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
So, I think I should just share with people how I first encountered you, which was I didn't meet you. I met your AI. And people kid around about this, but I'm not kidding around in this case. The software that you developed was called Lander, L-A-N-D-R. And I was working on a project, a music project, with my partner, Matt Oystreicher. And he said, let's try this new mastering software that's all AI-driven and online. And we used it for the project. And we would just plug in the songs. We send them down the line to the site. And they come back mastered. And you can tweak it for, like, you know, different styles of music and for different intensities of the mastering EQ. And I've been doing this a long time, as you well know. It was good. It's a great job. So you were the creative director for that company. And it was the first AI that I've seen or heard for the mastering industry. Is that right? Is it the first?
I mean, I think we were probably one of the first mainstream adopted AI tools, period, in the creative industries. Like, we were really early, definitely the first major AI music tool, and really early across the whole creative spectrum.
So, and how long ago was that?
I think we launched 7 or 8 years ago now.
Okay. So, yeah. Has that part of the industry accelerated since then? Are there other people trying to do the same thing, or how's it going?
There's some really interesting stuff happening right now. Like, I'd say the angle that I'm the most excited about, or where I'm seeing really exciting stuff emerge, is semantic. You know, the equivalent of there's these tools like DALL-E or Midjourney that where you type in text prompts and it creates imagery, visual images that are mind blowing. Like, it's incredible. You can literally say, like, a photorealistic picture of a Mike Kelly installation in the mountains, and it'll generate that. And it's astonishing. Like, and this is revolutionizing visual art, and really controversial, really wildly people are up in arms because some people are using it. Lots of, like, NFT people are making NFTs with it. It's like a super interesting new thing in visual art. I see couple of days ago, Google released a semiotic kind of music engine that's really interesting. And I think probably the place where I think that's going to have the first really big impact in music, and I'm really excited about it, and I feel like it's going to be revolutionary, is doing that for samples. So if you want a drum kit and you're like, I want a Chick Corea drum kit in a big room with, and you get, you know, a beat like for a J Dilla, you know, beat, and you can semiotically create these mind blowing samples. And I think that we're really headed towards that being a realistic possibility in the short term.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm sure for you also, but the different people, my larger sphere, some people are kind of like, no, it's going to ruin everything. And other people are like, bring it on. Right.
Yeah. I'm definitely on the second side of that. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I think it's complicated because I think it, you know, I used to do a lot of talks when I was developing Lander, and there were people who really, really violently hated the idea of Lander. And, and there, I get quite attacked. Some really famous people that really hated it too from the industry. And it was a revolution. You know, I think, and there's some really positive consequences and negative consequences of it. I think that there was a raft. One of the things that weighs on me heavily about the consequences of it was there was probably a good chunk of young engineers that were selling mastering services for 10, 20 bucks online. That was a bit of an industry, like, you know, and people could make a living doing that. And we definitely wiped that out, and I put people out of work, and our software put people out of work. So I feel like there's definitely a negative thing there that is complicated, that I think every AI maker wrestles with. I also think, though, from the craft and artistic, and, you know, Lander was an adaptation of, I think the reason Lander worked is because the world has gone from, you know, when you think about what mastering meant on when recording was wire, or when it was, you know, shellac versus disc versus album versus singles on Spotify, you know, or on SoundCloud, which it was when we launched, you know, and thinking about what does mastering need to mean in this world, and what does it do, and what, like, you know, an evolution of an art and an evolution of a way of thinking about what the current needs of something is. And I think it's really, you know, for me, there's some really exciting, great stuff that comes of it. So there, it's a bit of a Promethean bargain, you know, like, I think that there's, I think that there's stuff that AI is going to make. I was just hanging out with a really amazing Indonesian visual artist that I know. And he was showing me this crazy portfolio of AI imagery that he was making for NFTs. And I was just floored by it. Like, it was just mind blowing. And I was like, this is really exciting. And you see what someone like Nate does with this, where Nate's like taking, you know, these AI generated images, then pulling them into Photoshop, then doing video with them. And it's like, these things are just creative tools, right?
Sure.
They change the game creatively.
Sure.
And for me, this is, there's a democratizing aspect of this that I get really excited about. One of the things that I loved about Lander was that, as an experimental, very uncommercial musician, getting the kind of quality, like Lander beat Grammy Award winning engineers in blind shootouts, you know, and like getting that quality of mastering for my tracks,
wow,
was impossible. Like, you know, never in a million years would my music sound that good.
Yeah.
So, you know, being able to solve that problem for all the musicians that don't have the kind of budgets, you know,
sure,
is really exciting for me too.
So and you're really, Justin, you're really kind of, nosing your way into the kind of ethical dimension of being an entrepreneur, being a creative person, which is a very interesting topic these days, because I think people are not willing to leave that behind, but at the same time, things are moving along. And ethics, how do you frame your ethics? Where do you derive your ethics from? Would you define yourself as an ethical person?
This is a tricky question. Like, I think it, uh, I would want to know what anybody meant when they said that word before I said yes or no to it. So, you know, well,
what if you said what context. What if you say what you meant by it? What do you mean by ethics?
I think so. To the point of Buddhist practice, like I think that there's a very deep interdependence of your actions in relationship to other things. And the Promethean comment earlier probably came from an awareness of that or an engagement with that, of thinking about both the like I think about the Heart Sutra in relationship to this, like both the massive implications of all of our actions and the complete unknowability of what the consequences of them will be. So it's my ethics are a very humble relationship to both sides of that coin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe just concern for interdependence, like just even tracking interdependence, right? That things ripple and they have causality and understanding karma. Wouldn't you say sort of in a way understanding a bigger picture of how karmic interactions work and what the impact of things is?
And yeah, with also a big humility around the lack of ability to actually have the ability to see that. So and ambition at the same time, right? Like it's like there's this excitement of, especially with the kind of tools like AI and what's possible digitally, and living through a couple generations of the promise of digital tools and interconnectivity on the web and seeing it devolve into a, you know, or not necessarily devolve, or a ramification of it being a surveillance state and lots of really complex things that are not good, you know, and privacy being kind of almost wiped out. Like and all kinds of wonderful things happen. And I think a lot of the Web3 conversations that are happening right now also are kind of filled with promise and Promethean danger. And, you know, there's a lot of, it's the excitement of the sets of possibilities and the humility of realizing that you may not know what you're unleashing when you do it.
Well, you know, Justin, when we were talking, you know, more frequently a year or so ago about various things, one of the things that struck me about you is that you kind of had developed your the notion of maybe going to, where was it, Thailand or someplace, and just becoming a renunciate and a pure Buddhist monk Thai style practitioner. That's on the one hand. You know, the other hand, like you're diving headlong into the current zeitgeist and the entrepreneurial energy and the kind of tech energy and thinking very big about that stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So, if you remember in our conversations, I was saying like, what if you put those two things in a blender? What do you come up with? up with you is what you come up with.
I mean, they're always in the blender, I guess, you know. Like, I don't know how you, it's, I think that's a really interesting thing, because I'm not sure how you can ever separate them, you know, like,
Well, by through choices and lifestyle. For example, if you did go to, was it Thailand you wanted to go to? I don't remember.
Yeah, it was Thailand. Yeah.
And now, so there's a parallel universe in which we're having this conversation, but you're in a monastery in Thailand, and I'm saying, so how's your practice going?
Yeah.
That seemed like a real option for you, wasn't it?
It still is on the table. I got pulled into another entrepreneurial venture that I feel really positive about its kind of stuff that it's trying to do. So it's kind of sucked me away from that, but it feels like it is, as a really interesting thing. It feels like it's challenging me in the same ways, or at the same frequency, maybe is a better way of putting it, that kind of experience would challenge me and is asking a lot of the same kind of growth that I'd look for from an experience like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's the blender again, and I would feel like it's almost like, it's interesting, it's not dissimilar to the ethic question. Like, it's like there's a commitment to a certain kind of practicing of things, and hopefully the chance to experience great depth in those experiences. And, you know, when we were talking about going to that monastery, it's like, to me, the idea of a 3-year practice, it's the depth of it, right? Like, it's that you get to go quite far into it. And so far, the place in my life where I've had the great gift and opportunity to go far and go deep is in an entrepreneurial stuff, so that, you know, once you're in a certain track with that, it keeps poking its head up. There's more to be deep here, and I would be such a novice in the other practice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that thing, is where am I going to reach the greater depth and the greater challenge, you know, and trying not to be spiritually greedy with that either, you know?
Yeah. What is it that you're challenging? What's the challenge?
You mean in the entrepreneurial stuff right now?
No, period. You know, it sounds like you're looking for a challenge to me, if I just sort of vetted what you just said.
I mean, I think that there's a pretty solid Spinozist desire to live in constant good faith and growth, you know? Like,
growth.
Yeah. I mean, I think growth is pretty much the main practice, or, you know, spiritual evolution, growth, and trying to meet that in a karmic way of like authentically, I hate the word authenticity though, but trying to meet it from a genuine place of what your life is presenting you, or your karma is presenting you, or whatever, and find the path that's the deepest and richest to kind of keep moving.
I often have been using the word cultivation instead of practice lately.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I like that.
And then each practice, you know, people think, oh, I'm meditating and it's all one thing, but it's not all one thing. It's quite a plethora and variety of techniques and methods. But what is being cultivated, you know, what are you trying to strengthen? So, you know, in our, you know, Dharma Moon emphasizes the mindfulness as the sort of foundational practice. But we've gone quite a ways from there in terms of, we have a whole track, which Ethan Nickturn is teaching on a year-long Buddhist studies course, going deeper. And I also want to take a track where people are going deeper into the kind of thing we're talking about. How do you bring this stuff into the world more? And then people can follow their, you know, follow their inclination for a while. So mindfulness, you know, has, you know, sort of, I did this with the yoga world too. It hit a certain sweet spot in the culture. And then it kind of blossomed to a certain point. And then I can almost see all those people, like, they got on a boat, they went over to Queens. Here, I'm looking at these, and now they're in Queens. And you go, well, what am I supposed to do now? And, you know, I think that's the conversation that's happening pretty vividly among people I'm talking to, is, okay, now what? You know, mindfulness, and now what? And, you know, my friends at Headspace, which I have quite a few students from that environment, and I guess I've shared this in private, I don't think anybody's going to take me up on it, I said the obvious sequel is HeartSpace. Why wouldn't you just start the next company called HeartSpace? Because I think that's where people are looking to go, you know. I throw these things into the wind like dandelions, but HeartSpace. And you said interdependence and connection and karma, and how you are concerned that you're putting people out of work potentially with the AI development. That's the heart that's concerned. That's not an intellectual concern. That's a heart concern. So how do you bring heart into business?
Very precariously.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's maybe why this is still a path that's really compelling to me. I think it's a very complex question, especially because, or I mean, what does it, you know, in business, you're confronted with tremendously difficult. I joke, I was training, there's a a person I'm mentoring who I've just watched grow immensely from being in a low-level service job to being head of product for a startup, and that I've been involved in that path with that person for a long time and watching them just blossom. And talking about leadership in business being a constant game of, you know, those ethical exercises where you're like, you're standing on the train track with the lever, and one train's going to hit the cardiac surgeon that will save 8,000 people, and the other way, all the 10 people on the train die and hit a wall if you don't pull it. So, you know, and heart in relationship to those kind of questions is an immense growth opportunity spiritually that's filled with a lot of difficulty. It's a hard path. And when you're making decisions as a, I think the reason that a lot of people don't like being in business is because it confronts you with many situations where the options are tremendously difficult, and you're faced with multiple dilemmas that are all overcoded by the need for shareholders to make money. And it's the place for heart in business is right in the middle of that mess and very, very, very deeply engaging with that mess.
Yeah. You know, I do think it's the question of the time personally. I mean, it's mine anyhow. I'm you know, sort of having this kind of conversation. Because you can see it in, you know, heart leads towards altruism. And, you know, people who are very successful tend to donate to charities and things if they're so inspired. That's that the nonprofit model is the model. That's where I'm going to put my heart. But when it's business, people use the word like killer, and we killed it. And we, you know, it's like it's quite military in a way, and sports-like analogies. So the question is, can you be in a game? And I'm thinking of Little League, Justin. I'm going all the way back to the Little League. and you know, some parents are like teaching the kids to just like, you know, completely go after the win. And others are saying, let's have fun and let's be good sports. And I think that's what grownups are doing. They're figuring out, should we be good sports? Should we have fun? Should we be kind? Or should we kill it? You know, should we dominate? Should we be powerful? Should we control? You know, and it's almost like masculine and feminine energies in a way, if you look at things that way.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if, like, you know, I don't know if I would agree with that so much, because I feel like it's too reductionist. Like, for me, there's something like a lot of the really inspiring entrepreneurs I know, or people I know that are, you know, like trying to think of, like, understand that these are very complex sets of relations. Like, what is the, I think that, like, thinking a lot about what the outcome of what your product is in an interdependent way, and seeing the larger picture of that, means that sometimes you will have to be a killer to get there, but the larger outcome for the world is better. Mm. And that there's passages filled with great hazard along that way. And that, you know, there's parts. It's funny, I was thinking about that in prepping for this, like where I'm like trying to reconcile my practice with the work that I do. And the work I'm working on right now is this really lovely, very generous project that's got really great ethics and is very kind, and kindness is kind of baked into its DNA, but we still have go through passages with it where I have to fire 10 people, or I have to take a decision that has really intense consequences for certain employees or whatever. And so kind of walking through all of those, navigating all of that with, I just don't think there's a way that there's an existence that can just be not dealing with difficulty, complexity. There's a good conversation that happens in the entrepreneurial world where people talk about wartime CEOs and peacetime CEOs. And this is a very common kind of thing. And what's interesting is every company, even you know, the Cancer Foundation, or even like things that have exclusively great reasons, in their life cycle will need a wartime CEO. And so how do you, you can't, in the current project that I'm working on, training the leader and the founder to have different instincts than he has naturally, because the company won't survive if he doesn't, you know, and making that, and seeing that growth and seeing that person become stronger and more like the outcome, the really beneficial outcome they're trying to create, have a greater possibility of succeeding. So it's a little bit, it's quite a juicy, complex thing for me, this conversation.
And probably for lots of people, you at a certain point, if you really enter the arena of all this, you're going to have to enter the nuance and enter the complexity of it. From the sideline, you can have a, you know, a reductionist point of view. But when you're, you know, in the field, so to speak, and engaging the energy. So, you know, I thought as you were talking about that, there was an anti-war protest about 20 years ago, I think, in New York, huge. Don't even remember what war. And, you know, there was an Israeli guy there who was the, I think they were called peaceniks. But he was a Green Beret level guy in the Israeli army. And he was just basically saying, peace is not the goal, peace is the way. Mm-hmm. And I found that interesting, like, for people mm-hmm. who are having this conversation to go, yeah, maybe we make this move because it gets us closer to that thing where we can have a more expansive, like I can have billions of dollars and help out build dams in Central America mm-hmm. or whatever. But, you know, paying attention to the way as you're doing that seems to be important. That's what came up in my mind, you know, that you mm-hmm. can't put that off. You can't put the way off in terms of future consequences.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And it's how, like, I think that goes, that cuts even deeper in the sense that when you are in the most difficult positions of these, of running businesses, of, you know, growing businesses, that the way, yeah, I mean, there's some really great examples of this, like, you know, Patagonia is such an inspiring company and so mind-blowing. And they've had all kinds of challenges through the history of that company. And you look at the outcome of that company and how it's moved and how every step of the way the decisions have been really, really, really profound. That there's like, it's really, that is, I think, a great example of that. But I also think that they've had tremendous struggles and had hard decisions to make along the way. And it's actually more, to me, the quality that I aspire to, or which I have not achieved yet by any stretch of the imagination, but like what I want and why this has as much value as going to the monastery, is that learning how to participate in the way when you're in the middle of the most difficult situations is the work, you know, and that's the incredible work. It's really,
yeah.
I have a lot of growth to do still on that count, but it's nice growth to try.
Yeah. You know, my latest musing, which is by usually weekly because of something that pops out of the zeitgeist or the news, it's just that recognition that the wealth of this world is controlled by a very small group of people.
Yeah.
It's an, you know, for anybody who's got any political and social sophistication, I'm not saying anything that intelligent here, but at the same time, it dawned on me kind of, it cracked into my mind. And I thought, wow, like, you know, something like top 200 people own as much wealth as the bottom 50% of the population. I don't remember the exact statistic. And I thought, well, that's who you want to talk to. I mean, and I was on a podcast and I said, here's my email address. If you're a billionaire, you can write me an email and we can talk about, you know, meditation, and I won't charge you anything for it. Mm-hmm. No,
it's
charge.
Great. It's great.
Because, you know, Yeah, not that meditation in itself, you know, and there's, I don't want to promote any kind of particular tradition or anybody, but just some kind of contemplation practice for people who have accumulated so much power and wealth would be, and then for people who have not accumulated it, some kind of user's guide to how to accumulate some of it and use it effectively. So that's, you know, that's been my dance. You're as I said, a perfect fit for it. When we first met, I went like, this is a CSM guy if there ever was one. And, you know, so I've always looked forward to our conversations about it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. So how is your practice these days?
It was interesting. I went through a period of super rigorous practice, stayed in that for a very long time, was really missing being part of a community, you know, and maintained my practice without a community for some time. Found post-pandemic that the community aspect dissolved a little bit, and then got, as this project got more and more consuming,
right,
my practice drifted a little bit and got into that kind of terrain of really complex stuff. Had to work quite hard at changing some things in the organization, and my practice got eaten alive, and I really abandoned it. And and it's really interesting to me. I've been kind of, was actually really curious to throw a question back at you about this. I feel like there's one place where now I'm back in my practice, it's great again too, which is really interesting. And I wonder this about creativity and spirituality, because the part where I abandoned my practice was when I needed to be the most creative and creative in a slightly, I would say, dangerous way, in a way that wasn't sustainable for a long time, but needed a kind of excess or a kind of like a drive level that I felt almost was contradictory to my practice. And this is an interesting thing. I've never ever, like, always the peak creative periods in my life, my practice has suffered, and I've never been able to like kind of have the manic level of creativity that's really fueled some of the success in my life and a practice work at the same time. But the practice afterwards, oh my God, it saves my life. Like, I need it desperately. Yeah. But I go through one of those phases. And I don't know if that's a fiction or if that's a truth, but that's been a really interesting thing about the arc of the past, say, 12 months of my life.
So, yeah, and I've, you could say I felt this, you know, from our last conversation. It's the tone of this, what you're saying right now was fairly, let's say, evident. And I had just one thought, you know, we say first thought, best thought, right? Mm-hmm. Remember that? Yeah. So as you were saying that, here was the thought I had, and I'll just give it to you the way it came out of the oven. Tantra.
Mm.
Yeah. I didn't really shape that thought. But, you know, Buddhism is not really, comprehensively, you know, that's what we're trying to do, is give people a comprehensive package of it without them going down the rabbit hole of like, okay, now it's 15 years to become a Kenpo in this tradition. And that's not even, you know, that would be like a college level of teacher in the Buddhist tradition. But the three yanas, you know, the Hinayana and the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, Vajrayana method really emerged from a group of practitioners in India who were called Mahasiddhas. And they were very worldly people. There's a, you know, you can read about the 84 Mahasiddhas, and one of them, Tilopa, is the founder of the Kagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism and several other lineages. And he was a crazy guy, not in monastic context at all. And the person who had to deal with him was Naropa, who was a college professor type of guy. So that interface archetypically is, I think, very interesting for us as practitioners, where you go, everything's nicely packaged, makes good sense. Step A leads to step B, step C leads to step C. The outcome of mindfulness meditation, resilience, clarity, stability. Mm-hmm. Okay, this makes sense to work in stiff. You know what I mean? It's just like you could present that. Now, what if you entered the realm of energy though? as mm-hmm. it naturally expresses itself, with the premise that the individual practitioner is not going anywhere. There's nowhere to get to. Right now, you are there. This is it. And that kind of quality of like mm-hmm. abrupt, in Shambhala, we call it suddenly free from fixed mind. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole plethora of techniques for reminding ourselves that something, an energy field is immediately available to us on the spot at any mm-hmm. time. And it's like flipping a switch kind of quality. Now, without mm-hmm. the grounding in the mindfulness practice, it's not going to be, people can get very spun out and tripped out. But with that proper grounding, and then most importantly, proper grounding in Mahayana, so that you dedicate the merit, you feel the heart is really, you never lift off above that level of compassion, and you dedicate it that way. But then there's a lot of other meditation, quote unquote, techniques that are available to rouse energy, a kind of sense of fierceness and creativity. And you know what? It's, I think I told you this, but when I was in Bhutan and driving on those crazy roads there, and then going to these monasteries, I was reading, somehow I was reading Ray Kurzweil's book on Singularity at the same time. And I've always, as you know, because we've been friends, I've always been interested in virtual reality, AI, all that kind of stuff. And then I was going from that notion into these monasteries, which were like 100 feet high, covered with tantric deities, in all, and rupas, statues, and rituals that are going on, that would be kind of like somebody would go, look, I didn't read about this at Headspace. And it's really like going into the energetic dimension of life and the immediate quality of it. So that's when, I'm just telling you, that word came into my mind while you were talking about it, not just for you personally, but for all of us, to consider the possibility that what we're cultivating to some extent has access points right now for us, if we could see it that way. But it can't trump the compassion. It can't. If it does that, then you have a warning sign.
Yeah, for sure. And I've seen, I've definitely encountered a number of people who are on that trip, like where they've lost track of the Mahayana and are deep into a kind of other space. And it's really interesting too, because people. Yeah, I have a good question for you. Like that, when you run into people that are in that space and they are recognizing that they need help, but they're very resistant to it because they also feel. There are a couple of different people in my life that are really deep in that kind of space, and then also feeling like they've unlocked the secret, and they're triumphant and they're on a super power trip with it, but are also really obviously suffering. And I'm curious if you have any advice on how to like advise people that are in that kind of space, because I feel the suffering and I feel the immense amount of compassion towards that set of challenges, and really don't know how to communicate across that sense of power that people are having, of this very ego kind of explosion that happens with that.
Well, ego getting its hands on the tools of enlightenment is called Rudrahood, and there's a whole kind of classical archetypical story about that. But really what you're talking about, I think, fits into, remember Awakening from the Daydream and the book that I wrote and the six realms. Yeah. You're really talking about the God realm and the jealous God realm as far as that. What is it? Each realm of Buddha is doing something different.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. Yeah.
But the human realm is the one where the most direct Dharma teaching can happen. So people are they have some poignancy, some passion. They recognize success, failure, life, death. There's more fluctuation. In that fluctuation, it's easy to insert new information. But the gods have stabilized a certain amount of pleasurable outcome, and the jealous gods have intentionally sought to stabilize, that outcome, whether it's psychological or metaphysical or materialistic. And it's very hard to talk to them. That's why I freely gave them my email address, because I know they're not going to write. You know, and that's challenging. Some people, you know, present the spiritual, and traditionally those people have been, you know, donors or patrons. If you look at a great, you know, one of these whole monastic systems, they'll have people like that who are patrons, but they're not hardcore practitioners usually. So everybody could give, but yeah, how you teach Dharma to somebody who's will reframe it as victory instead of surrender. Anyhow, that's my thought on what you said. I hope.
No, it's great. Yeah. Great.
What is the project you're working on now? Can you say?
It's called Play Fit. It's the idea is there's some really terrifying things happening in the world. If you think about the millennials with people's physical lives. So if you think about millennials, they were the first generation to grow up with the internet. The generation below them has grown up with the mobile internet and colossally addictive stuff in the palm of their hand. And the health implications of that have been disastrous. So we have like all kinds of spinal problems in young people. We have obesity rates that are higher in 20-year-olds than they are in 50-year-olds. We have, you know, like unbelievable diabetes stats in young people. And so a couple of really smart people, my ex-CFO at Lander founded a company with a physicist in Montreal, John Guimet, and they're both just the greatest people. And they, I was advising them from early on, and they built this really awesome thing that is basically the general principles of it are, let's take all the tools that we have for getting people addicted to flipping through things and liking things and doing whatever to get people to move and to get people to be embodied and to get them to start being physically active.
Well, that's amazing.
Yeah. So it's kind of the goal of it is we, and it's great. We use machine learning. Like it's another AI project. So like, you know, how, if you think about how Apple's fitness stuff has made, you know, people much more aware of their steps and stairs and all of that stuff because it tracks it automatically. Well, machine learning can do that for push-ups and sit-ups and dancing and breathing and whatever. And so we train all these models on basic physical activities that anybody can do anywhere without needing a gym, without needing a Peloton, we make the whole world a Peloton. So like basically you can use your body and the phone to do activities and get rewarded for them. And we build this whole reward cycle in, make it a game, make it fun. And we use the AI to effectively track people's activities, and track's a dangerous word to measure or like we don't keep any data about anybody. We're super ethical about the privacy stuff. It's incredibly important to me. But we help people learn and grow. And then on the other end, the AI also understand you as a person and understand your activity and builds a personalized coaching program for you that sets the bar and changes as you're having, as if you get COVID and your activity drops, it sets it lower again.
Yeah,
it raises it as you're doing stuff.
It's clear. It sounds clear as a bell. You know, just the light is about to bleach you out. Just, I don't know if you've seen your own image there.
That's great.
To be honest, I was digging it, you know, so, it was about to take over, you know. When I do the podcast, you know, Justin, you know, he dissolved into light at the end of the podcast. So, don't come on the podcast unless you're ready to dissolve into light. Yeah. So that's such an interesting sounding project, and make the whole world your Peloton. Is that jumped out at me as a catch line. Some version of that is cool. Now, what's the name of the company again?
Play Fit.
Play Fit. And is it out yet?
It's on iPhone. We just made a major upgrade to all of it. It's cool. I think the next release is going to be even more exciting. It's really great. You can get it on the Apple Store. Android will come eventually. But I highly recommend picking it up if you want to move more. It's great. It really helps everyone just move
and
more.
And what did, are you the CEO of the company? Are you the creative director? Are you a marketing guy? What's your role?
I think my official title is COO. So I'm in charge of everything, basically, like all the, like, I direct the product. I do everything except for kind of the fundraising and larger scale stuff, which is what John does. And John runs the tech team. It's not unlike Lander, where I was the product design thinking and Stuart Mansbridge was the technical director. Great, brilliant technician and technologist. I love Stuart. He's with a great company called Subpack now, who does really cool stuff. John is the technical lead, and he's a physicist that has a patent in quantum computing. He's amazing, genius, brilliant guy. And I basically am running the product and marketing and all the kind of.
Well, that sounds like a very full-time job. Is that a very full-time job?
There's a lot of hours in the day, but yeah, it's busy. Yeah, definitely busy.
And the company's private or?
It's we just raised $3 million, $3.something million. We have outside investors. We're doing another round in probably 6 months, if everything goes to plan. And it's a really exciting little project. It's nice to take all the AI stuff I learned and I think after Lander, trying to think about a bigger market and that the outcome of the benefit would be larger, you know? And so finding something where we could take what I learned there and have, it's cool at scale. Like, you know, if we get to 10 million, 100 million users, we'll have a meaningful effect on morbidity rates. You know, we'll have a meaningful effect on hospital bills. We'll have a meaningful effect on healthcare costs in the US. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to try and do.
Yeah.
Very, very, very challenging but wonderful. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, what do I know? But it sounds like a home run to me. There's something about
hopefully.
It. Well, it kind of falls out. You know, you hear people start talking about something, you go like, you know, it kind of falls out gracefully like a slinky starts going down the steps on its own, you know? You know, when you drop a slinky down a flight of stairs, it just goes, next step.
I mean, the biggest thing for me that I love about it is that we get people writing in reviews that are like, this helped me after I had COVID. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. We get people, we have people saying they've never had motivation to move ever in their lives. We see in the stats, people come in and they move 500% more after 3 months of working with us. Pretty. And it's just like, just seeing that and knowing what that means.
Sure.
For a body and seeing the people that are using our app go through that journey is like, it's so satisfying. It's incredible.
I'm just starting to roll with it, you know, like just like an ad. Like, you still have a body, you know. You show some kid, you still have a body. Now maybe 200 years from now, maybe you won't. But right now, you know, because people are being sucked into a vortex right now. That's very mental space, you know. And even sitting meditation, you got to relate to your body to do that.
100%. And I mean, you know, for me, the meditation practice and also my wife's teaches this really incredible training system called Gyrotonic. Like, I actually believe that intelligence is also embodied and that your physical, you know, which goes back to yoga practices, everything, you know, like, but the body can't be separated from the head. And and I'd say one of the larger projects for me one of the main drivers for why I feel really passionate about PlayFit is that getting someone from not moving to moving or moving very little to moving enough is the biggest hurdle. Once they're moving enough, then they can do yoga, then they can do Gyrotonic, then they can do whatever. And that's such a smaller gap than not moving to moving. And so helping people at the very bottom of that process feels revolutionary to me and really, really something I feel really, really passionate about.
I don't remember the name of the movie, animated film, very popular Disney film. In the future, just piles of garbage on the earth, and the people are in space, and they're these little fat, little doughy bodies with little hover carts with the computer in front of them. What was the name of that movie?
Is that Wall-E? I'm not
thinking. Yeah, Wall-E. No, Wall-E. Wall-E. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's a perfect image for it, you know?
Well, and I think, you know, also for me, karma-wise, like being involved in having a lot of my success grow with the early internet and AI and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It was really important to be part of leveraging those tools for the benefit of mankind, you know, the Mahayana kind of way. Like that feels incredibly important to me.
Sounds good. Really does sound good. Yeah, great, very happy to hear about it. It's kind of a compelling project. And you know me, I get excited when I feel that energy gathering in a good way. So there's one other piece of the puzzle, which most people don't know about you, is that you're a musician also.
Kind of.
Well, okay. you own.
I mean, I have so much respect for people that I consider musicians at a higher caliber than me that I'm not willing to take that mantle on. But I made a lot of music for a number of years.
You own some instruments in any case, right?
I own some instruments, yeah.
And any outlet for that at the moment, or any chance to play or do some creative music?
You know, I was working on making an instrument, and I've been tinkering away at that for a long time because I really love microtonal drone stuff. Mm. And the idea of making a microtonal glass harmonica is something I've been really, really fascinated with for a long time. And so I've been noodling around with kind of getting actually Tibetan bowls made at very specific mathematical frequencies and trying to like build harmonic sequences out of these bowls that then eventually could be put on a rotator and done. It's kind of impossible to do what I want to do with glass, which is why I wound up with the bowls, because the frequencies get so intense that the glass will explode and it becomes a very, very dangerous instrument. You know? So trying to figure out how to make it work with metal, and it's been I've been playing around with this idea for about 4 or 5 years now, and it gets more serious when I have more time, less serious when I have less time. But it sounds really beautiful.
And your wife has a really cutting edge dance troupe. Is that still happening?
Yeah, she's killing it. She's doing a bad choice of words. She's
she's loving it.
She's loving it. She's making really incredible work. She just created a really phenomenal piece during the pandemic. Two big things during the pandemic. One was a series of 7 films that was the genesis of was missing collaborating with new artists that you'd meet when you'd be at festivals or as co-performers. So she just decided to pair up 3 people that she knew independently of each other to make these short films, short dance films, and got people to collaborate across the pandemic, across cities, across the world, made 7 films called Jump Cut and the series.
Jump Cut.
And that series was shown at the Club Transmedia Festival in Berlin, and they built this really beautiful installation space for it. It was fantastic. And then she also created a dance piece that they rehearsed outside during the pandemic. It was unbelievable that she pulled this off, this large-scale dance piece. They were doing rehearsals in public parks and stuff so they could rehearse. You know, during the whole, just like her commitment to making stuff is unbelievable. And it just premiered last year. It's called Creation Destruction. It premiered in Toronto in this beautiful outdoor park. And now the piece, it has a string section and a choir, 10 dancers, these amazing collaborators, United Visual Artists from London who built this mind-blowing screen. It's an incredible piece. And they just got some great news that it's going to get booked for some touring and continue on.
And what's the name of her company?
Animals of Distinction.
Animals of Distinction. Yeah. Wow, that's bold.
Yeah, she's bold.
I'm sure she captured your attention at some point and never gave it back. Yeah. Well, how cool. I mean, you know, we haven't really talked in maybe a year or so. So it's for purely selfish reasons. when we thought of people having the podcast, I said, well, this will give me an opportunity to catch up with Justin and get current. But also, I do feel that your the arc that we've covered in the conversation is very germane to what I was hoping to, the energy field I was hoping to connect with CSM, you know, creativity, spirituality, and making the buck. Mm-hmm. And in the cover, if you remember, they had the three people. One was a monk, one's a musician, and one's a businesswoman.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist rendered it as they're walking up the hill towards the monastery. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, turn them around. They're walking down mm-hmm. from the monastery. They're re-entering the phenomenal world with mm-hmm. some kind of sense of bringing that into fruition and into manifestation level. And definitely, you know, not that I want to, you know, frame your life in terms that are like easy for me to resonate with, but I think it's a fit that you are really trying to put those things together. And so the monastery thing could be for a month or 3 months. That's something we start to experiment with, like temporary ordinations and things like that. You know, I went to a 3-month seminary at the peak of my career in the 70s. I was doing a lot of scoring and stuff, you know, that people will start to like go, okay, I could do some deep practice. And even a weekend or a week long practice and then re-enter.
Yeah.
So the last thing I want to say to you is that, you know, the 3-year retreat, you know, which is a famous, you know, Vajrayana retreat, you know, is, three years, 3 months, 3 days. And, supposedly at the end of it, you know, you've gotten a lot of, high level, instruction, you could say, in terms of the nature, quality of mind, how to work with energies and so forth. But there's a phrase that captured my mind when people came out of it, and it's called entering the action.
Mm.
And at the end of the 3 years, you're supposed to be able to seamlessly enter the action. You just, you are no longer distinguishing between this, this, you know, it's one taste. Yeah. Officially, it's called one taste, you know, and, you know, I think this is something that when you gauge somebody's kind of quality of cultivation, realization, do they turn it on and off? You know what I mean? Or are they comfortable entering different situations and become embodied with the kind of qualities that they've tried to develop? So, you know, you're always welcome at Dharma Moon. We think of you as part of our expanded ecosystem. And part of the Sangha there, you know, so you're always welcome.
I miss it.
Yeah.
I miss it. I think I'll have to come visit. I miss it a lot.
Yeah. You have a open invite to come join in. And PlayFit was the company. I think people could check that out and get. I feel like that's almost a perfect example of what we've been talking about. You're actually trying to generate benefit. You can do it in a way as you go that is compassionate and smart. So congratulations on that. It sounds like a really great project.
Thanks. It's such a pleasure to catch up with you, David, and I look forward to more.
Yeah.
And I also want to say that, like, the idea of this podcast, attending this CM, the creativity, spirituality, making a buck workshop was fantastic. And both in seeing, you know, one of the things I really admire about what you do is you were meeting all the participants at the level they were coming to the event with. And I think it's a really tricky thing to do. And I think it's incredibly important because often with those three poles, you know, one of them is really strong and the other two are really weak, and it's always a different mix with each individual. And seeing the way you and the team were able to nurture and support people's different relation to those poles was really inspiring. And I think the work you're doing with that is really great and makes a lot of value. And so I just, thought it's in honor of the topic, I think it's that workshop's really great and it was really nice to participate in it. Really inspiring.
Thank you so much. And hope to see you soon. And thanks for joining the podcast. And everybody out in podcast land, we'll see you again soon.
All right, folks, there you have it. Episode number 40 with Justin Evans, entrepreneurship, technology, and spiritual practice. We would like to thank Justin for joining us and generously sharing his time and wisdom with the podcast. And we would like to thank all of you for listening. We sincerely hope that this podcast is of benefit to you. That's our aspiration. Also, big thanks to Justin for that shout out for our CSM workshops. I'm not sure if we have any on the calendar currently, but keep an eye out at Dharma Moon. We do those workshops about once a year. Also, friendly reminder that this podcast is based on David's book of the same name on Wisdom Publications. So if you're looking for some personal development in bringing these three threads together in your life, I highly recommend the book. And if you're going to do the book, get the workbook that's a part of it and do the journaling. It's a really good exercise for insight and shifting our behavior and relationship with ourselves and others. All right. My cell phone just went off, but this is a one-shot take here on the end. And again, go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. Go to DharmaMoon.com. Thank you to everybody at Be Here Now for continuing Ram Dass's legacy and your assistance in the production and distribution of this podcast. If you like this podcast, tell your friends, share on social media, give us 11 out of 10 stars on whatever platform you use and a positive review. Say hello to us on YouTube. I don't check the YouTube comments super often, but I do sometimes. And if you have a recommendation for a discussion with David and I or for a guest, shoot me an email at michaelk@dharmamoon.com. Well, all that arises must dissipate, and we've reached the end of this podcast. So all of us here at Dharma Moon and Be Here Now sincerely wish you all the best. Thank you for listening. May you be happy, safe, healthy, and at ease. All the best.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest right now? Are you feeling lonely, unappreciated, or misunderstood? When you keep these feelings bottled up, they can affect you negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's a great way to increase your self-awareness, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.